meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It is Saturday, May 21st, 2011, and we will be taking up the omnibus pension bill that Senator Rosen is authoring, and it is Senate File 1369, and there are some more copies of the engrossed bill coming down, but we've been keeping the copy machine running and trying to get them done as quickly as possible. But I do believe all the members have their copies in front of them, and we're going to ask Senator Rosen and Mr. Martin to give us a summary of the bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. First, I'd like to just kind of give a brief history of Senate File 1369, where it started. We had the 2001 Omnibus Pension Bill in Senator Perry's committee today, and that dealt with just several issues from we just picked just several issues from a long list of pension issues this year and dealt with those in the two meetings that we had. And one of them is the Minsky defined benefit default, which is the default pension plan coverage for newly hired employees of the Minnesota State College University system. And it's changed from a defined contribution from the individual retirement account, the IRAP, to the Defined Benefit Teachers Retirement Association. And the change in default coverage only applies if the employee has service credit in another public pension plan that provides a combined service annuity portability provisions. We had a very good discussion on that in Senator Perry's committee. It also has the White Bear Lake interim actuarial valuation, and a very important provision for the Duluth and St. Paul teacher benefit adjustment, which actually saves the state money and brings it in line to what we did last year in the pension reform. So there's a greater an increase in the employee's contribution. And then there are several other provisions in that omnibus bill, such as the actuarial assumptions revisions and some other small individual provisions, such as Senator Tomasoni's para service credit purchase for certain former employees of Babbitt and Buell. Also, Senator Howe had the para coverage for employees of the Red Wing Port Authority. Senator Tomasoni also had the Hibbing Relief Association report deadline extension. And Senator Olson has the TRA salary credit purchase for Hopkins part-time teacher. Those were the provisions in the omnibus bill. And this then it was amended with the Minneapolis Police and Fire Associations to the agreement that was made with PARA, and that's what we have now is the Senate File 1369. This agreement, this voluntary consolidation of the police and fire with PARA is historic, I should say. And it's been in the works for many, many years, and there's many people that would like to testify on the historical aspect and what was agreed upon. I also have Mr. Martin here with the Pension Commission that can go into more aspects of it. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm open to questions, or maybe perhaps Mr. Martin could go through the finer details of the bill.
Mr. Martin, I think we would probably like a little more detail that would give us some more background for questioning.
I think Senator Rosen has covered the first five articles, which were recommended by the Pension Commission. They are mostly either things that were deadline or date specific. Where this session of the legislature didn't handle them, they would cause some considerable harm to some group of public employees or some municipalities. It also picks up on issues that were left over from 2010, such as the St. Paul teacher and Duluth teacher benefit adjustments or benefit downsizings that picked up on things that were done in the statewide plans, but not in those two plans. I think the new items that were in process and added today are the last three articles of the bill, and they start on page 32 and run to the balance of the bill. Article 6 relates to the Minneapolis Fire Plan. Article 7 relates to the Minneapolis a police pension plan, and Article 8 is a conforming changes provision, cleaning out the references in statute to the Minneapolis police and fire plans in the event that they do consolidate. As Senator Rosen has mentioned, this is a voluntary consolidation, so the consolidation is triggered only after there have been several approvals. The approvals have to be of the Relief Association Board, the Relief Association membership, the Public Employees Retirement Board, and the City of Minneapolis. And the two consolidation efforts are tied together. It's also a precondition for the consolidations that they both have to consolidate, not just one or the other. Articles 5 and or 6 and 7, when they were drafted, the provision tying the two consolidations together did not occur. So there's a lot of parallelism in the language between the two articles. They were initially, when drafted, anticipated to be freestanding, that one could consolidate when the other did not. So all of the necessary changes had to be made independently for each. So if you're going through the bill and you read Article 6 and then all of a sudden hit Article 7 and find it looks an awful lot like Article 6, that's the reason why. It's essentially the same operative language. In trade for giving up the prior post-retirement adjustment mechanism that these two plans had, which is known in the pension trade as an escalator, it's basing current retirement benefits on current active member pay levels, and increasing whenever the pay of a first-class firefighter or a first-class patrol officer increases. That post-retirement adjustment mechanism is being eliminated. The 13th check that the Minneapolis Police and Fire have been eliminated. Also, the 110% funded additional lump sum post-retirement adjustment is being eliminated. In return for that, and as part of settling a lawsuit between the City of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Police and Minneapolis Fire over a difference as to whether the salary that drives the escalator was properly determined, the city is agreeing that there will be a redefinition of the unit value. This is the baseline salary figure that's going to be used for calculating benefits. And there are increases in that unit value for both police and for fire for the period 2012 through 2015. Then after 2015, the salary base that drives all the pension benefits for these two plans would increase only at the percentage rate that the PERA, police and fire post-retirement adjustments, are given. And under the 2009 and 2010 legislation, those omnibus pension bills, that's currently limited to 1.5% per year until the plan achieves 90% funded, and then it would be limited at 2.5%. The City of Minneapolis continues to be obligated to pay the actuarial liability, any unfunded mm-hmm. pension liability for these two plans. The amortization date for the two plans is extended. The current amortization date, target date for the Minneapolis Police is 2020. For the fire, it's 2025. The extension is to the year 2031. So there is some deferring or extending out the funding. But the City of Minneapolis makes a baseline contribution payroll period to payroll period, and then also makes an additional lump sum payment annually based on the unfunded pension liability of the programs. The benefits of the current members of the plan are essentially governed by the current Relief Association benefit plan, but the plan will be administered by by PERA. So we're replacing the administrations of these two plans. The administrative cost of these two plans has been higher than that of PERA, our police and fire, by quite a bit. So there are savings there. By virtue of changing the amortization date for these two plans, Minneapolis will be eligible for amortization aid for a period that longer than they currently would be entitled. This does not, however, increase the state's liability. The amortization aid, when it is freed up, when a plan becomes fully funded, is redistributed to other pension plans that have unfunded pension liabilities. So what this really reflects is who's receiving, not how much the state is paying. It's about $1.7 million that's at stake for Minneapolis annually, about $1 million for the police and about $700,000 for the fire. And those amounts would not be freed up to be distributed to the St. Paul teachers, to volunteer fire plans, and some other plans. Of Virginia Fire, if it still has an unfunded pension liability, until a later date, 2031, rather than 2020 or 2025. Probably the last thing to note, the two relief associations are permitted to retain to continue in existence as fraternal organizations, not pension plans. These two plans have been in existence for over 100 years. They have strong loyalty with their our retired members, and there's a desire to maintain as a fraternal organization the remnant of each of the relief associations. With that, members, I think maybe the best thing to do is to hear briefly from representatives of the two parties to the lawsuit to give you some sense of why the settlement occurred, and then I'd be happy to answer questions after you get to that background, which I can't really provide beyond what I've already done at any great level. I'll discuss with you or help you understand how this settlement is played out in this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Senator Rosen, did you want to bring some other people?
Madam Chair,
to the
table? I would. There is Mr. Brian Rice here and Ms. Hodges from the Minneapolis City Council. And while they're coming up, I just want to reiterate a few things that are very important in this. Number one, that it's extremely historic. I wish there was a lot of work on this, and the deal came through at the very last minute. And that's why we're working very hard to get this through, and I appreciate it. I also want to mention that this, again, is totally voluntary. The pension fund members have to vote on it and approve legislation on a majority vote. The Minneapolis City Council has to approve it, so does PERA have to approve it. And the SBI determines what asset it receives. And if any one group does not approve the arrangement, the entire arrangement fails. Some of the other really important principles are PERA is to be held harmless, and the pension funds in the city have to pay their own way. There is no subsidy. Unlike the Minneapolis teachers and MRF bill, there are no new state aids in this bill, and there won't be. The retirees and the widows get a benefit adjustment that is appropriate, and they're going to PERA and giving up their escalated pensions, post-retirement benefits, and the 13th checks along with a health insurance program. In exchange, the retirees will have an increase in the stability of being in a larger fund. The membership in the city and the Minneapolis business community support this benefit increase and the bill. And the city gets significant short-term and long-term property tax relief. The Minneapolis business community strongly supports the property tax relief. And the city also gets certainty in its levy and no longer bears the risk of stock market crashes. The city also saves by not paying for two pension fund administrators. And the state's interest is that the policy of the Pension Commission has been to support consolidation of what were once 47 plans, and now we're down to two. And one of them is mine in Fairmont, actually. And the state also will be more able to control and address the pension policy. So there is no new state money in this bill, and the city has agreed to pay more if the state changes the interest rate assumptions. In other consolidations, the state took the risk, and in this case, we're making Minneapolis bear the risk. So I just wanted to make sure that we clarify that. And with that, I have Mr. Brian Rice and Ms. Hodges from the Minneapolis City Council with me.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing this bill tonight. My name is Betsy Hodges. I am on the Minneapolis City Council, Chair of the Ways and Means Budget Committee. Senator Rosen explained quite thoroughly the advantages of this for the parties involved. It has been a long time that we've been working to find a solution to the challenges that this situation has posed, and I believe this is a good one, and I know that the city has full support behind it and fully believes that this is the best solution that we can find to a very practical solution to a problem that we face. And so I thank you for your consideration tonight and urge your support.
Thank you, Ms. Hodges. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice, Rice, Michaels, and Walther. I'm in the General Counsel for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association and the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association. And these two organizations also endorse the bill and are asking the committee and the legislature to enact its provisions. Their context is important to this issue. The funds and the city have been involved in litigation for almost 5 years now on this issue, and they'd previously been involved in the issue of how do you define salary. This legislation, if passed, is in addition to the items that Senator Rosen pointed out and Councilmember Hodges pointed out, also a path to resolve that litigation and simply put this issue to rest. And so I would add to the list that Senator Rosen enumerated also the economy of not keeping this litigation going, which could be an additional burden on the court system for several more years, given its extreme complexity. One item that I think I heard before the meeting from Senator Rosen, there's going to be possibly some questions, concerns about the numbers in this settlement. One very important thing to understand is that the members in these plans are basic plan members. That means they are not coordinated with Social Security. The fire pension plan is 125 years old. The police plan is 121 years old, dating from 1886 and 1890, respectively. These plans were set up well in advance of any plan that the state set up, well in advance of the Social Security system, and the members in these plans are not in the Social Security system. The average age of there are about 1,400 members. They live all throughout the state of Minnesota. There's about 920 active or service pensioners, 480 surviving spouse widows. The average age of those surviving spouses is 82. The average age of the service pensioners is 72. It's an extremely older cohort of individuals. I've represented these plans for 29 years, and as I've gotten older and they've gotten older, I'm very much aware the people I represent are older and very vulnerable. We're talking now of that cohort of widows, which is about one-third of the whole membership. In 10 years, half of this membership will be women. Right now, their pension benefit, based on the decision of Judge Poston, provides these widows about $2,000 a month to live on. And quite frankly, that's not a very large stipend. And these women, whose average age is about that of my mother's, are like my mother. They didn't work. I mean, they were homemaker. They did work, but they were homemakers. They worked very hard. They worked harder than I have. But they don't have Social Security by their being mothers and raising families, and so they are very vulnerable. And it's this lawsuit has been very difficult on them. They've gone through it. I also think as they've moved forward, this settlement makes some sense for them. It's going to provide a increase in their benefits, but if we rolled the clock back to where they were at before the litigation and then rolled these numbers forward, you'd find that the forward numbers would be very similar had there not been a lawsuit and the projected increases had just occurred. So the membership looks at these numbers as simply putting them back in the place that they would have been. And because of the age of the system, Mr. Martin did an excellent job summarizing some very key provisions of plans they have. They have an escalated pension that tied the pension of the retiree and the surviving spouse to basically half of what an active police or firefighter made on the streets of Minneapolis as determined by the collective bargaining agreement, and the surviving spouses got half again that amount. All of these members paid in exactly the same amount, whether they were the chief of police or a starting patrolman or firefighter. It was a very egalitarian system. There was one amount of pension for everyone, and, you know, they stuck together. That was the deal. There are no, you know, golden parachutes in this plan. I talked with Ms. Vanek today. Basically, this plan, when fully implemented, would basically bring members of this plan to about the metro average of what a PRA, police or fire officer, earned who was in a community like Bloomington or Edina, other cities that never had their own plan. So the evaluation of the membership is that it's a fair settlement, it's reasonable, it's one that, given the age of the members and the situation they're in, that they support it, endorse it, and we feel that it can stand any test of fairness that members of the legislature or public or others would do. And I might add, I mean, to get to these numbers, it was a very long, intense negotiation with the city of Minneapolis. The parties have been strong adversaries to try to, in litigation and other matters, and we think that this settlement or proposed settlement could withstand any scrutiny that that you members should and will hold it up to. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've forgotten your name, I'm sorry.
Brian Rice.
Mr. Rice, you've indicated that with this settlement, there will be an increase in benefits to certain people. Senator Rosen has indicated that there is no new state money that's going into this matter. Could you describe for me the terms of the settlement so that I can understand a little better?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman. The terms of the settlement are basically in the bill, but the primary financial terms of settlement are to establish a unit value. And a unit is defined as 1/80th of the monthly salary of an active police or firefighter. And that members then, based on years of service, are entitled to a certain number of units. And again, as I said, it's roughly 50% of the salary of a working police officer or firefighter. I think perhaps, Senator, the question you're wondering, how can this work where there's one value that exists now in this transference to PRA? And it's possible to effectuate the settlement for a couple reasons. The interest rate assumptions for these plans is they assume to earn a return of 6% on investments, and salaries will increase at 4%. Those assumptions, by any actuarial standards, would be among the most conservative in the country, with an expectation of earning investment rate of 6% and benefits increasing at 4%. The current comparable PRA set of assumptions is an 8.5% investment return, Senator, with a COLA of 1.5%. And the differences between those investment rate of returns, PRA is higher than the relief associations, and their post-retirement assumption is much lower, basically allows the funds to go to, if you will, the PRA window and buy a benefit that's slightly, that is larger, and at the same time provide significant relief to the city of Minneapolis. And you know, how those assumptions get developed are a topic the Pension Commission is going to look at. But a large part of the advantage is this. The time horizon for this fund is very short in an investment future when you have people that are in their 80s and 70s, whereas the time horizon that PRA can have for its investments, because it's taking in new members, It's a much larger plan. It's easier to make an assumption that projects a higher investment return when you have that larger set of assets and a larger horizon time set in members. Likewise, probably why this is made possible is the reform bill that was passed last year and a series of reform bills the legislature has passed in the 5 years to cut the post-retirement benefit of existing public employees in para. Senator Olson made the comment earlier today. There's been a series of two or three bills that have taken that post-retirement formula you give to existing employees from a virtually unlimited increase of anything over 5% back to a COLA that's was capped at 5%, then 2.5%, and last year in para police and fire at 1.5%. And as the state has tightened down future increases, it's made the ability of these funds to go into para and get a better formula possible.
Mr. Rice, can I just ask a quick question? Isn't there a lawsuit pending about us reducing those rates?
Madam Chair, you are correct that the decision on that, Madam Chair, it's a lawsuit that's venued in Ramsey County. Chief Judge Johnston has the case. They anticipate a decision in June. That case involves the para members, and you are correct. That case is pending.
My concern is, of course, if we lose it. I am not sure how, if we'd have to go back to former rates before the reduction, it would have a huge impact on our funds.
Senator Roebling, you're correct. That potentiality is there. And I'm not, in this case, in this consolidation, we have a voluntary feature of it, and the membership would decide it's a corporation. I would think that this case with those COLAs would be, they would be different, but they are tied to those projected COLAs that were changed in the legislation last year.
So, Mr. Rice, you said that in this provision, we will have the employees or the former employees or retirees agreeing to it, which would be different than what we did previously.
Madam Chair, that's correct. This case, this consolidation will require a majority vote of the entire membership to effectuate the consolidation, which in effect would be a consent to the new plan, the para plan, by the membership, which in my opinion would raise an extreme, put a bar to litigation, given that they're a member of a corporation, they voted to decide to do this, and they agreed to it.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the settlement, if the membership has the ability to accept or reject this, what happens if we, agree and pass this legislation and the membership then decides that they don't like it? What happens with our settlement?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, this bill would have no effect. There would be no settlement. The bill requires all the parties to accept it or none of them to accept it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the court involved in any way in this settlement? And is the settlement subject to the approval of the legislature?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair, at this point, the agreement in the settlement is that upon all the parties agreeing and consolidation occurring, the city will dismiss its lawsuit, and the funds agree with that.
Mr. Rice, so the vote of the retirees occurs before the dismissal of the lawsuit?
You're correct, Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Rice, earlier on in response to I think it was Senator Newman's question about how does this work. You've got a liability and you transfer over and the liability kind of goes away or improves and there's no money coming into this deal. And as I recall, you described it as, well, the one plan was assuming a certain interest rate, and the new structure assumes an 8.5% interest rate. And my question is, if those, first of all, I think it's very difficult to guarantee interest rates performance into the future. And if that doesn't occur, what happens? Who provides the guaranteed payout to the pensioners?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, the bill has a provision that if interest rate assumptions by the state are changed, the city of Minneapolis will bear that risk. And so to that extent, on the unfunded liability, should the legislature review the rates and decide 8.5% is too high and too aggressive a rate of return to assume, if it's lowered, Minneapolis has agreed to accept that risk. If overall the interest rate assumption is not met and there is a shortfall because the plan has an unfunded liability that's built up, for example, in like the last stock market crash when the funds were about 100% funded, there was adjustment. I would suspect that what would happen is that the pension funds administrators, like they did last year, come to the legislature and redesign the plan and try to right size it like they did last year.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and just how realistic is the assumption that 8.5% that these investments will generate 8.5% in perpetuity? I mean, isn't part of the problem with these structures is that there's been assumptions of return that just aren't maintained, and so therefore over time they tend to erode, and pretty soon you've got commitments that can't be met out of the investment. Isn't that partly the problem with this that has created some of the issues that we're now trying to address, and why would we make that assumption going forward that somehow that's going to be different? Wouldn't it be the same?
Mr. Rice and maybe Mr. Martin would like to talk about some of the historical returns on our state funds, too.
You know, Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, you're asking a very prescient question and one that I believe members of the Pension Commission plan to address, and the Mr. Chairman Lanning has indicated they will address. Howard Bicker was here earlier today. Speaking for Howard Bicker, since 1980, I believe the rate of return that the State Board of Investment has earned since 1980 has averaged 9.5% approximately. And I've heard Mr. Bicker testify in House committees that he is very confident that he could maintain that higher interest rate assumption from his perspective. Now, he's the manager of the State Board of Investment that has about $50 billion in assets. You do raise a good question, though, Senator. Can that rate be sustained, and since that becomes a very key building block of the system, that Mr. Bicker would say, and the average have indicated that they could do that. The market has had a very significant rebound since March 9th of 2009. The Dow Jones was at 1,400, went down to 6,500. It's back to 12,500. It's one of the big questions you have, basically, if you're going to look at defined benefit plans. And it's a consideration. It's a mandated study that the legislature passed as a reform initiative. That report's coming forward in June of this year, and it's a topic for debate. I would submit to the committee, in this context, with these funds that predate it, I know there would perhaps be a reluctance on the part of the I can see where that you could say there's a reluctance to deal with this. In fact, however, Senator Rosen indicated 43 of the 47 relief associations have already taken a consolidation route almost exactly similar to this, using very similar assumptions. And it's been a plan that's been extended to every other city in the state. They've folded into the PRA Police and Fire Fund. This is one of the last four to do it. And I'd submit kind of on past history and equity that allowing Minneapolis to do this and consolidate into the plan, we can't really undo the past. You can do stuff going forward, but allowing the city and the members to enjoy the benefit of that would really be extending a courtesy to them that was already extended to all of these other plans and cities. And that policy has been extant from the legislature since 1987 to have this voluntary consolidation, and this is really one of the last steps in doing it. And if you get them all in the plan, you'll have to deal with it as a group, and we think it's appropriate.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not certain if Mr. Martin wants to say anything, but at some time I would like to bring up Mary Vanek from PRA. She is also on the Investment Advisory Council and could perhaps address Senator Hand's comments, too.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Rice's comments there about Mr. Vicker, I believe he also told me that when I had spoken with him early on, part of the issue, of course, because I'm concerned that we're releasing post-retirement increases when we have funds that are not fully funded. And I believe he agreed with me in my office that the worst thing we can do is release an increase before we're fully funded. And you just drive the fund backwards. And that's why when I look at this, you know, I think it's page 9, and I see post-retirement increases that are being given before the fund is 100% funded, in my mind, is wrong. And I think all pension funds should be capped and held tight until we have that 100 to 105% funded. And then you start releasing post-retirement increases. I mean, I still, my blood still boils some when I found out in testimony last year that the city of Minneapolis didn't make payments like they agreed to. And in this bill, you're telling me they're going to if there's differences. And we had testimony right here that Minneapolis didn't pick up their fair share, and when they said they would. So what's going to change between that MRF account and this account that we discussed last time when they didn't pay their fair share? And so I don't know how one could believe that they're going to do anything different going forward here when they have shown that they didn't in the past.
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Perry had a couple questions there. With respect to the unfunded liability issue, it is a concern. But again, I come back to this point. For these individuals, they're not in Social Security. The only pension that they get is really dependent on what this legislature grants them. And given the vagaries of the stock market and funding and employer contributions, employee contributions, to tell individuals who've performed service to their city, to their state, there are still 13 widows in this plan whose husbands died in the line of duty, to say that you're not going to get a raise unless the plan is fully funded is a very difficult circumstance when health care costs go up, food, other cost of living matters go up. Social Security has a system that provides for a cost of living adjustment, and people could argue whether that's appropriate or not, but that's just a fact of life if you're going to maintain any kind of standard of living after you retire. The second question I think I heard Senator Perry say was, what's the assurance that the city will make these payments? I would say this. There's a long history that could be discussed over 125 years about Minneapolis making payments or not. For a very long time, the city didn't. It was a pay-as-you-go plan, but I think that's, you know, from 1886 to 1970, after that period of time, there's only $300,000 in the fire pension fund. It was only about 5% funded. The legislature then stepped in to address that funding situation and started requiring the city to make payments. It stepped in again when it closed the plan in 1980 and set forth an amortization schedule. And for the most part, the city has met that schedule. That's why these funds are relatively well funded. Unlike MRF, again, MRF required a very, and Senator Perry, I know you were very concerned about that bill a year ago. It required, we were dealing with a $600, $700, $800 million unfunded liability that hadn't been addressed. That's not the situation with these plans. There are assets there that can buy a benefit. And then with respect to the last question, Ms. Vanek's at the table now. The system going forward is that, well, Ms. Vanek can explain it, but basically Minneapolis would be agreeing to a payment schedule, and it's going to be their obligation to make the payments. And Mary Vanek is a very mild-mannered, nice person, but my experience with her, if she says you do something, you better do it or else.
Ms. Vanek, would you like to share some information with the committee?
Certainly, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the director of PERA. First of all, with respect to payments by the city, PERA does have the authority that if an employer does not make the requisite payment to the pension fund, that we can go to the county and ask that the county auditor levy taxes to ensure that we get the payment. So we have that authority for any local unit of government that participates in PERA. We are entering into this agreement with the city of Minneapolis with the understanding that that the board has really part of the agreement, final say in this when we get through the entire steps. So the pension board's membership vote that they want to go forward, the city of Minneapolis still wants to go forward, the PERA board is going to have an opportunity to look at the numbers, talk to the parties, and make sure that we all agree on how this is going to proceed. With respect to the investment rate of return, which is certainly, it's different than it is for the local plans, these funds will go into the portfolio with the rest of the pension assets that the State Board of Investments takes care of. And the current legislative return on investments is stated to be 8.5%. There is active discussion about changing that, and so we ask that this bill include language that states specifically that if that return assumption is changed from 8.5% to something lower, and we are already collecting payments from the city of Minneapolis, that the payment amount be recalculated with the lower rate of return so that we are sure that our pension fund is made whole. We are certainly going to experience some downturns. We're not going to make 8.5% every year, but if you look at the state board's experience, their asset allocation expects that two-thirds of the time they're going to make 8.5% or better, and the other third they will be below that. And over time, since 1989, when 8.5% was set as the rate of return, that's exactly what they have made. They've been 8.6% or higher 17 out of those 22 years. And this last couple of years certainly wasn't a typical down market, so we're comfortable with the return we've experienced. But if the legislature chooses to lower that rate, we also have the assurance in this bill that Minneapolis will have to make up the difference in their annual payment and have it recalculated.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Just to that structure that you've described, but isn't it true? I mean, if you're describing that over some period of time you've got an average of 8.5 or whatever it might be, but if during that period of time as you experience the vagaries of ups and downs that can be dramatic, but every year you're paying out a 1.5% increase for cost of living, and anybody who exits, you're paying them the 8.5% increase. Doesn't that erode your principal? I mean, there's nothing tied to the payout that reflects the shift in the market. So if you are in a down market, you're still obligated to pay at the higher rate. Isn't that true? And if that's the case, then over time, don't you erode your fund? And isn't that, in fact, why we've got these problems that have been going on for decades, that the structure just can't be guaranteed in the way that we would like it to be? I mean, we all would love to have, I mean, I'd love to have my IRA be guaranteed to perform at 8.5% forever but it won't. I mean, there are things that happen. And if you're at the same time, you're promising people that you're going to make a payment and you get into one of those downtrends, then you end up at the end of that time with less money in the pool, and you have to try to make that up. And so you have to hope that the market goes up to 16%? Or, I mean, how does that work? I don't understand the logic of that structure.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I really wish Mr. Bicker were here to talk a little bit more about this. But just trying to, this is a, that you're talking about a huge policy issue that was pretty well vetted, I believe, last year and the two previous years. The Minnesota Systems used to have what we called a post-retirement fund. It was a separate portfolio of assets for the retirees. And beginning in 1993, the structure paid out all the good returns. And we recognized soon after that structure was put in place that that was a flawed structure. The chair of this committee can speak to the fact that we did come forward and say that it needed some fixing, and that didn't happen. And it wasn't until that post-retirement fund fell below 100% funded that we got the attention of folks that this structure is flawed. In 2006, those increases were capped at 5% to be implemented later because we needed to get IRS approval. But in the meantime, we had to do something much more serious about addressing the issue. And in 2008, we came forward with a major reform that set the increases to 2.5%. And they were set at a fixed 2.5% because our contribution structure actually has active members contributing and their employers to pay for that in the future. That's included in our contribution structure. But because of the Great Recession, we did have to come forward last year and seek further reductions. Another thing I'd like to point out is the fact that these two plans that are being merged with us are closed, and so their high liability structure is with the retirees. The para plans are open. I hope that we will always have law enforcement and fire personnel continuing to contribute to our plan, and the fact that we are actively opened plans with new money coming in puts us in a much better position to be able to earn whatever the 8 or 8.5, currently 8.5. I'm expecting that there's going to be a lot of lively discussion at the Pension Commission over the interim about what that rate should be going forward. So that open plan structure, however, is what really makes this merger work and made the merger of the other 44 plans in 1999 also work without having a significant impact on the police and fire fund overall.
Ms. Vanek, how long have the mergers with the other funds been occurring? When did they start?
Madam Chair, in 1987, the legislature passed a law that voluntarily allowed each of those independent paid fire and police plans to move through a process with their membership and their sponsoring city to have para takeover administration. So by 1998, we had 44 separate accounts of individual plans, Austin Police, Austin Fire, Rochester Police, Rochester Fire, that we were administering separately. And we worked with the Pension Commission actuary in 1998 and advanced a bill in 1999 to actually merge them into the para police and fire plan. And those plans that were underfunded, that were less than 100% funded at that time, also were required to make an annual payment over a 10-year period to meet their obligation of what their unfundedness was at the time of the merger. And they finished their payments 2 years ago. We got the last of their payments into the system. And it has worked. It worked well.
How did the numbers compare of retirees? This has to be I've never heard how many people are, yes, we did hear. It was 1,400. When you took those other 42 or so, was that still a smaller number, or was that somewhat comparable, do you think?
Madam Chair, I think collectively it was probably a comparable number. The largest department we had consolidate and then merge with us in that period of time was St. Paul Police and Fire, and I don't think they were quite as, I apologize, I don't remember the numbers, but I don't think they were quite as large as the Minneapolis group, but comparably, when you added all those systems up, total numbers were certainly more than the two Minneapolis funds.
Thank you. Other questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Langston.
Well, I had read someplace that every 30-year period, we have exceeded 8.5%. You had mentioned the last 30 years it was 9.5%, but if every 30-year period we exceeded 8.5%, it doesn't seem to me that we are out of line in what we're hoping for in the future. Certainly doesn't guarantee that it's going to happen in the future. But the legislature is in session every year, and we'll be looking at it every year. So we're certainly getting back. I think didn't we at one time have $60 billion in the funds and dropped down to 36, and now it's back up to 50?
That's my understanding.
So it's heading back into a very sound position again. We don't know if we're going to get there, but it looks like we're heading there.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Senator Langseth, the State Board received the authority from the legislature to move more into equities in 1980 and to hire outside money managers. And from that point forward, investment performance improved dramatically. We didn't go to an 8.5% rate of return assumption until 1989. And in 1984, I believe it was changed from 6% to 8%. So it has changed over time, but it certainly was based upon what was going on in the markets. Mr. Bicker and his staff, under the advisement of the State Board, has done very well since 1980. It's an over 9% return, I believe 9.7 since 1980, 9.2 over the last 25 years. This year, thus far, since July 1st, we're sitting at about a 22% return. And last fiscal year, it was a 15.2% return. So certainly, they have maintained a consistent asset allocation and believe, you know, in staying with that consistency when the markets dropped significantly in 2009, they were buying stocks. Right now, when they're getting these greater returns, they're selling stocks. They're keeping their asset allocation pretty consistent, and that's why they've been as successful as they have.
Are there any other questions, Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair, that's impressive.
I was impressed, too. I wish I knew their tips.
They did almost as well as Senator Rosen's portfolio.
Are there any more questions about this section, or would members have questions about another section? I was just wondering, Senator Rosen, and not about this one, if we're ready to move on to another, about the Minsky defined benefit default. I'm trying to understand what is happening there and if it's only for newly hired employees, so that people who have been in a couple of systems, I'm trying to understand. So if they had service credit from another system and then they've been in Minsky, or is it vice versa? I'm trying to understand the correlation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we had, like I said, a good discussion about this in Senator Perry's committee. I have with me Mr. Thompson from TRA, and he can verify that. But it is for newly hires.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, I'm Luther Thompson, Assistant Executive Director at TRA. What this provision does is default newly hired Minsky teachers who have prior allowable service in para MSRS or in the state plan, so that they're put in the appropriate plan. The way it currently works, you may be, for instance, you might have been a nurse covered by para, and then you're starting to teach in a technical college. You might be part-time, and then all of a sudden you go to full-time, and you never realize that you're automatically put into a different plan. The appropriate plan for those people with prior allowable service, 9 times out of 10, will be the plan that they were in before they became covered by IRAP. And they still have an election. If they choose to go into IRAP, they can go into IRAP if they think that's the better plan. The way it works now is that everybody that's hired by Minsky gets 1 year to make an election, and they're defaulted into IRAP immediately, so that until you make that election, you end up with some service in IRAP. Now, IRAP is certainly more appropriate for the, you know, the IFO faculty and those folks that, you know, have gone from, you know, one college to the other. But primarily for people in the technical colleges that have prior allowable service, they're already in para, MSRS, and TRA. The appropriate default should be to TRA. And if they so choose to go to IRAP, if they think that's a better plan, that's up to them. It's not really about which plan is probably better philosophically, but it's only about the default for those people that have prior allowable service.
Mr. Thompson, what effect does it have on the TRA plan when you automatically enroll them into that?
Well, they're already enrolled in para, MSRS, and TRA. They've already been making their employee and employer contributions, and they're already covered because of the combined service annuity by all of the plans. It makes no difference to TRA. They simply make the TRA contributions that they would have made previously, and they may be, somewhat different from the para and MSRS contributions, but they are now a TRA member, and all of that service in para, if they have prior service in para and MSRS, is combined when they retire, just like it is for anybody that shifts from a para plan to an MSRS plan to a TRA plan.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You described that for these individuals that have had previous coverage, that it's appropriate, more appropriate for them to go into the TRA rather than the defined contribution IRA. Why do you say that? Why is it more appropriate?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I mean, they're already in one plan, and I think before they make a choice to get to another plan, we're just simply talking about the default when they're first hired. It's up to them to make that choice. But in almost all the cases, I think counselors would probably counsel them to stay in the defined benefit plan because they already have prior service there. If they think personally they're better off in the IRAP plan, that's certainly a provision. Also in this bill, there's an issue about the counseling for new members. MNSCU is going to be required to, I guess, to be more careful in their counseling of the new members, because we do have issues where members have come back, they haven't been counseled, they weren't told about the different advantages or disadvantages of the various plan, and so we end up with somebody that has an individual member bill, and this should clarify that. So this is simply about the choice will continue, but it's about which plan should they be defaulted in when they become a new member of MNSCU, if they have allowable service in one of the other plans already. If they've taken a refund and no longer have allowable service, they will be defaulted to IRAP.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For a new hire in MNSCU with the prior service, would the new hire be able to, in effect, elect to go into the defined benefit plan for future benefits?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, if I understand, if they have prior service, they will be defaulted into the defined benefit plan until they elect to go to the defined contribution plan. They'll have a one-year period to do that. Administratively, it makes it easier for us to transfer, if they elect to go into the IRAP plan for that new coverage, it's easier to transfer the money that way than it is to transfer the money back from IRAP to TRA.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
My question specifically is, they are able to then remain or elect or be in the defined benefit plan for their future benefits. Is that correct?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, that's correct.
Before Senator Berlin?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make the motion that Senate File 1369 be recommended to pass for Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Before we vote on that, I know some people are sitting here, and I know the hour is late, but if there's anyone else who wanted to testify for or against the bill, now is your opportunity.
Vote against it, if you testify.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I just want to say something about the MNSCU like I said, we had a lot of debate about it, but Senator Gazalka and Senator Daley, both after, you know, after you completely understand it, they said, this makes sense, I'm all for it, let's vote on it. So it is a good provision. We did take out one of the provisions that was controversial, of the MnDOT employee, to move this forward.
Okay. Well, if there's no other discussion then, Senator Berglund moves.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
Now, I'm just going to weigh in one last time because I think it's a bad bill. I think it's a very bad bill. There's no reform in it. To Senator Rosen's own testimony, the part for Minneapolis was never vetted in the pension committee. This is wrong for this to move forward. I don't agree with it. I think the pension committee has had two meetings this year. They couldn't have had enough time to look at this bill. And it's disappointing because they let us down. This is not a good bill, and I won't be voting for it, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, that is not the truth. That is not what I said in your committee. We had two pension hearings on the omnibus bill. We had an informational hearing on this pension bill, or on this Minneapolis merger here. There was some issues about it, and that's why we were not comfortable with taking the vote at the time. Those issues have been worked through diligently by a very large group of dedicated people to make this historic consolidation happen. And as it turned out, it happened yesterday. So instead of taking it back to the pension commission, we went to the pension members and asked, are you okay taking it straight to state gov? And they said yes, because this is an important bill. And I am not going to allow it to just die without working very hard to get this agreement pushed forward. So we did not have our pension meetings because the House never mentioned or got their pension committee together. That's why we only had three pension hearings. It wasn't the Senate's fault. We worked real hard, and there is no pension reform. We did a historic pension reform last year. Mm-hmm. We need to let that work. It is working, obviously, by the figures that you've just heard tonight. So this is another movement. It will work because of what we did last year. Let's let the system work here.
If there's no other discussion, Senator Langston?
No, I just...
Okay. Senator Berglund renews her motion that Senate File 1369 be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Nay.
The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam
Thank you,
Chair
Senator
members.
Rosen.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, everyone, for staying up late. And the meeting is adjourned.